It's The Week on Wednesday, and I'm your host, Van Badham. This week, we discuss Scott Morrison. It's a gas, the Prime Minister's ideas for a gas-powered recovery. We also discuss Victoria opening up at last. We have a special guest, Terry Butler, the Shadow Environment Minister, who will be talking about the fact that Australia is currently winning the extinction wars in the worst possible way. But as usual, the most important piece of information is who is with me. He's gorgeous, he's brilliant, he's funny, he's clever, he even makes me cups of tea at night time. It is, of course, Ben Davison. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Van. How are you?
I'm good. And Germanicus, our Dachshund puppy, is on my lap being very cute.
Yes, he was quite involved in the Terry Butler interview, so you'll probably hear more of him later on. So let's dive into it because there's a lot to cover off in such a short period of time.
Now, Benjamin, I know you're dying to talk about gas. I know that this is one of your favourite things to talk about.
Well, it is, partly because this is one of the great smoke and mirrors economic plans.
Smoke and mirrors.
If I can use the word plan in its loosest possible interpretation when it comes to Scott Morrison. So people might have seen this week that he's announced $52.9 million to unlock the gas in Australia.
52.9? Yeah. Why? Yeah. That's a quarter of the rescue package they gave to the arts that they don't care about.
Indeed. And frankly, it's not a lot of money for an industry that claims it needs $6 billion to build a pipeline from WA to the east coast of Australia. Now, the whole announcement is kind of muddled up and mixed up with a sort of series of hollow threats to the energy industry about building their own gas-fired power plant. This comes back to the Liddell power plant in New South Wales. People might remember that slated to close. It's been a lot of uncertainty, mostly created by the Commonwealth government around Liddell. The AGL, the company that owns it, wants to replace Liddell with renewable sources of energy. The National Liberal Coalition has been up in arms about this since it was first announced some years ago. And now what we're seeing this week is the kind of Commonwealth imprimatur of gas being put to the front and centre with the threat of creating a new gas-fired power station at Liddell or near Liddell. And this really has all come about because NEV Power, people might remember the COVID commission was set up and NEV Power was made chair, and NEV Power and a bunch of the other appointees to this thing are very gas-focused.
From the gas industry?
One of the companies that he has been chair and major shareholder of is a gas and oil company. And prior to that, he was from CEO of Twiggy Forest's mining company. So this is a guy who's deeply embedded in the fossil fuel industry. And of course, you put him in charge of how we're going to reconstruct Australia, and he's gone straight to his well-known, tried and true playbook, and that is more fossil fuel. There's just no basis for thinking that $59 million is going to somehow solve a multi-billion dollar economic crisis. And Stephen Koukoulis, the very well-respected economist, has called this a con, has said this won't provide the support the RBA would like to see to the economy. And frankly, they're right. You know, $59 million over 5 years to build a few pipes and some kind of hollow threat to build a power station that nobody wants, that nobody will fund, that is uneconomic in any way, is a bizarre thing to call a plan for recovery. And frankly, you know, won't create the kind of jobs that we need to replace.
Now, it is bizarre because the whole rhetoric of the Liberals and the Nationals, because they are ideologically neoliberal, is that government should be small and government, it's not up to government to pick winners and losers, apart from, you know, making sure they keep poor people poor. And, you know, the government shouldn't intervene in the economy and no central planning and all of these things. And yet they're willing to build their own gas-fired power stations, just as they've threatened in the past to build their own coal-fired power stations, in order to, you know, literally die from lack of oxygen and carbon monoxide poisoning on a hill of climate change. Like, it's unfathomable.
Well, it does come back to a little bit of what you've just touched on, and that is that there are some LNP people in Queensland in particular who want another coal-fired power station that nobody wants to build. So this is the crazy thing about it all. This is, as you say, a government that claims to believe in markets, yet is more than prepared to intervene with a type of technology that nobody wants to fund, nobody wants to insure, nobody wants to build.
No one wants to maintain.
Because
strangely enough, extremely large buildings that are about setting things on fire generally require rather a lot of upkeep.
Oh, they do, huge amounts of maintenance. And that's one of the big problems that we have in this country, is that the old coal fleet does require large amounts of maintenance, and being privatised now as well, there is a way to game the system. And lots of the power companies do game the system by taking offline many of the generators that are required for maintenance, or scheduling the maintenance at a time which will improve the price for them, i.e. the cost for us. Now, creating a new power station that uses gas or coal and then inevitably flogging it off to a private sector provider, which is what Morrison will end up doing, is only going to make that problem worse. This is about propping up, if you like, a system that isn't working properly as it is. Now, there's lots of things to be said about gas and why gas is important, and gas is a major export. But we should also remember that we've essentially privatised this to the point where, even though it's one of our major top three exports and has been for a few years and will be into the future, we make almost no money off this as a country. So this is money that goes into the pockets of corporations and executives and shareholders. The royalties are very, very small, and the taxes that these companies pay are very, very small. Other countries get a lot more for the gas they export, and they put that into their own country, they put that into the infrastructure they need to move to renewables, all these sorts of things. We're not doing that. And of course, at the same time, because these companies are looking for the best price, they're exporting overseas, or they're selling domestically at a higher price. So it's cheaper. If you're in Japan, it's cheaper, or has been cheaper, to buy Australian gas in Japan than it has been to buy Australian gas in Australia. And that is just blows my mind and blows a lot of people's minds.
But this is the thing, the argument from Morrison and the Liberals, and let's remember, since they were elected in 2013, the Liberals have had 14 different energy plans, none of which have really come to fruition. But their argument is always that, oh, we're doing this to bring down power prices. And I'm looking for the evidence that any of this will bring down power prices, given the fact that various Liberal governments gave away price and control of energy in Australia through privatisation.
Yeah, and essentially what unions like the AWU and many other unions and industry participants have said is that we should be reserving gas, that you do need some price control mechanisms. And one way to do that, that other countries have done, is to reserve a certain amount of supply for domestic consumption. And that encourages also companies to look at other ways to generate energy, because if it's essentially you're foregoing profit to have to supply the domestic market, then you'll look at other ways to generate energy that might be cheaper, and that drives innovation. So there's a whole raft of steps that can be taken that will both lower energy costs and improve our use of renewables and better technological solutions.
And encourage the use of renewable energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're not doing any of that.
Which is, of course, coming down in price worldwide and attracting lots of investment and building localised manufacturing industries in the countries like Germany and Denmark, who've invested in the production of renewable energy parts, components and other bits and pieces.
Absolutely. And Ross Garnaut talks about this in his book, Australia an Energy Superpower, about how if we harness the opportunity of renewable energy, then we will have manufacturing in our regions again, for example, because it will be close to cheap domestically produced energy, locally produced energy through renewables.
And not to mention, I remember something that I thought should have got a lot more attention at the time was in Bill Shorten's election pitch. when Labor launched their campaign for 2019, one of the things he talked about was Australia is the only continent on Earth that naturally has all of the material required to make the batteries for like industrial sized batteries for the renewable, you know, for a renewable energy grid. And he was committing Labor to building that manufacturing capacity so we could become an exporter of the batteries of the renewable revolution. And of course, that's all gone. The Liberals didn't steal that policy. We're talking about, you know, we're talking about the technology of a century ago today.
It's a very Australian issue in many ways, because we have for a long period of time relied on the bounty of our natural resources to sell to the world, and we haven't really invested, despite lots of government lip service, we haven't invested in a complex, diversified economy that would allow us to do things like build and export batteries for the solar revolution, because it's been easier to a degree to kind of give in to the vested interests, even though they only, you know, they do employ some people, but we're talking about less than 2% of employment is in some of these sorts of industries, these extractive industries, yet they totally dominate policy making when it comes to what are we going to sell to the world, how are we going to build our exports. And it comes at the cost of actual investment in a complex and diverse economy. I think we're ranked something like 91st when it comes to these things, when it comes to being a diverse economy. Now, that's really very dangerous. It means that we're very much at the whimsy of international prices for things like coal, iron ore, gas. It means that we're selling these things overseas for profit rather than using them domestically to build our own technology capacity, base, and our own capacity. And it means that we don't have the skill sets that we need. At the same time, of course, you do all the other things like gut TAFE, make it harder for people to go to university, and that just compounds the problem and makes it worse. And that's where we find ourselves.
I just find it so frustrating because we have an economic crisis. We know that unemployment is out of control because of coronavirus. We know that massive investment is going to need to be made in order to get Australians back to work and give them opportunity. Simultaneously, there's a climate crisis that requires immediate redress. So you have a government that has every pretext in the world to walk, you know, to step away from their neoliberalism for 10 minutes, come up with a plan that actually looks at investing in stimulating industries that create jobs in manufacturing, in reforestation, in revegetation, in regenerative agriculture, you know, the mechanisms of climate action, which actually can be geographically targeted. You know, I'm so desperate for this government to create jobs and to create and to be behind some environmental action. I will personally identify in each marginal seat where they could build some infrastructure to get Australia on that road, but they just will not do it.
And it's really sad because you see Joe Biden in America doing exactly what you're talking about. So during the primaries, he committed $1.7 trillion US dollars over 10 years to jobs in climate action, effectively. And he recently upped that to $2 trillion over 4 years. And people are going, oh, you've moved to the left. And he's saying, I haven't moved to the left. I've realised we can create more jobs. We can create more jobs and we can have a better environmental outcome. That's worth the investment. That's what I'm doing.
You know, Biden's message in the election campaign on this issue has been, they say hoax, I say jobs. And it's like, you know, why would you? You don't even need to believe in climate change. I mean, you should, because that's what evidence tells you to do. But, you know, don't you believe in jobs? Don't you believe in opportunity in your community? Don't you want to look at your kids, you know, your partner and go, yep, there are opportunities opening up here. There's going to be a thing. There's going to be training. This is going to happen for us. And what that does for local small business and that kind of targeting, I just, like, it's the rhetoric that the Liberals insist on, that they're these great economic managers, and you hear it all the time, indefinitely. We've been hearing in this country since that party was founded in the 1940s, and yet where is the evidence? You know, are our lives any better than they were when they were elected 7 years ago? No.
No, we have more job insecurity, we have lower standards of living, we have lots of problems that, frankly, as a result of government policy or lack of government policy. In fact, there was an article, I think yesterday, that was one of the coalition MPs saying we have to be really, really careful with what we're doing on coronavirus and the pandemic, because people are starting to realise that homelessness has been eradicated by government policy in almost every state.
Oh, well, we should be careful. We can't let anyone work that out.
And literally has said that we have to be really careful about that, because people will start to realise that government policy determines the level of poverty and homelessness. And when we go back to pre-COVID, which is obviously their view that there's a pre-COVID way of going, we don't want to continue these policies. Now, that is one of the most remarkably cruel, callous, un-Australian things I'd ever read from any member of a political party, that you would deliberately try to manipulate the circumstances to maintain a level of homelessness in this country, even though you know and are discussing the fact that you can eradicate it. That blows the mind, absolutely blows the mind. But when you put that into the context of we're going to spend $60 million on gas and that's going to solve all of our economic problems, you start to have a picture of a political party that forms government that doesn't really want government to do things. And we all pay the price for that. It's going to continue on. The gas policy is going to get more and more announcements, I think, between now and the budget. We can expect that to be a centrepiece, even if it's not real investment, a centrepiece of the rhetoric between now and Christmas at least. And frankly, we just have to keep an eye on it. We have to try and hold them to account on it. Speaking of holding people to account, we had a really good discussion with Terry Butler about the environment laws.
We really did.
So maybe we should throw to that interview that we pre-recorded earlier today. And Terry Butler is, of course, the federal member for Griffith and the shadow minister for environment and water, and spoke to us about the Morrison government's undermining of environmental protection and undermining of the process of environmental protection, which is not only damaging the environment and our animal populations, but also actually harming jobs and business as well.
Yes, we got some information yesterday that showed that sometime before they even got the interim report for the review, the government started commissioning the Parliamentary Council to start writing proposed legislation. Now, this is a really important review. This is the 10-yearly statutory review of the environmental law. It's Australia's most important environmental law. It covers matters of national environmental significance. And it's really important that we do have a good, strong review of the laws, because they need to be kept up to date. And in fact, the government appointed someone who's a very experienced regulator, Graham Samuel, to lead the review, and then a panel of people to back him in. And he actually drafted his interim report and gave it to the government, as you say, after they'd already started getting the Parliamentary Council to start writing laws. And then we got it sometime later. And that interim review is pretty, it's just pretty damning of the state of environmental protection in this country. And Graham is not really considered to be he's not an environmental activist. You won't see him out the front of rallies or protests. He's a businessman, he's a regulator, and yet the report itself is so blunt about what he sees as the failures. He says that the current environmental trajectory is not sustainable. He says we've got to stop managing the decline and actually start to see some improvement. He points out that not only do people not have trust in the environmental protection laws, that some of that lack of trust is actually warranted, because there's not really enough information for people to be satisfied that the laws are working to protect species. And when you put all of that together with the fact that we're in an extinction crisis, that Australia leads the world for extinctions, that we are actually seeing a biodiversity crisis as well as a climate change crisis, when you put all of that together, that's pretty clear indication that we need to do more, we need to do better, we need to actually take a proper look at how the environmental laws are working. And that's why it's actually just so frustrating, apart from anything else, that the government preempted even the interim report. And then what they did last parliament sitting, so 2 weeks ago, is they actually tabled a bill that was remarkably like an Abbott era bill for the environment that the parliament had already rejected back in 2014-15. So it's all just a bit of a shame, really, Van. And Ben, they've derailed the environmental reform process. I hope that it can get back on track. I hope that they're going to start taking the review seriously. I think that they need to come forward with some really serious proposals that are consistent with Graham's report, the interim report, and the final report's due out in October, but there's some things the interim report said should start happening now. And one of those things that needs to happen is they actually need to find some common ground, bring people together, get a consensus on environmental standards. Because what we really need is a set of strong environmental standards that give us a bit of a roadmap for how we're going to actually do better when it comes to environmental protection.
Can I just absorb for a moment that Australia leads the world in extinctions? Like, that's not really a competition anybody wants to win.
No, it's a real shame. And, you know, a lot of the scientific community and the environmental activist organisations try to talk about this issue, and it does get lost. And look, it particularly gets lost during a global pandemic and a recession. Of course, people are really focused on the material conditions of their own lives. Of course they are. I mean, everyone is. And I know you and a lot of your listeners are in Victoria, and you're coping with lockdown, you're coping with the constant uncertainty and worry that the pandemic brings. So it is possible for the sort of high-level environmental messages to get lost. But if you think about a really, I think, emotional event that happened this year that did bring the issue of species loss to the forefront, that was the bushfires. You know, we had this national bushfire crisis. At the time, the estimates were a billion animals killed. Now the estimates have gone up to around 3 billion animals killed or dislocated, displaced. That, I think, was a really big wake-up call for a lot of Australians. And they saw these images of, you know, burning koalas. I saw a lot of injured koalas around the bushfires, koalas that had really suffered, orphan joeys, and that, of course, brought these issues to the attention of the Australian public. And I really hope it doesn't take another national bushfire crisis to get people to really focus on environmental protection, both for iconic animals like the koala, but also much less charismatic animals like the fluorescent pink slug. We do need to be focused on it, because one of the problems with us all being so rightly absorbed by the pandemic and the recession is that things can happen without attention being given to them, and we need to make sure that there is scrutiny and that someone is watching. And as part of an opposition, that falls in a lot of ways to us. You know, we need to have the scrutiny, we need to have the constructive criticism, and we need to be holding the government to account, which is what we're trying to do on environmental protection and the question of extinctions. There is a Senate inquiry into extinctions at the moment that is ongoing, and it's been doing some really good work too.
Terry, while we're talking about extinctions, and you raise koalas as well as the fluorescent slug, but I mean, koalas have featured in the national news again because, of course, the koala has nearly brought down the New South Wales government and sort of
revenge of the koala.
Imagine being against koalas. Come on, guys.
But is there a broader ideological point here about the coalition parties? You know, in New South Wales, it's koalas. Federally, it's preempting environmental reviews by respected and appointed by coalition government bureaucrats to weaken the laws. Is there just some ideological opposition to the idea that we need a livable environment?
I really think there is, Ben. And, you know, the stupid thing about it, so Abbott gets in, right? The Liberals get in, end of 2013. One of the first things they do is cut 40% of the funding out of the Environment Department, right? They start to sack staff. You know, they've cut 40% over the time they've been in, but they started the cuts when they got there. At the time, we said, hey, guys, if you sack 480 staff out of the Environment Department, that's going to have an impact on whether the Environment Department can actually do its job. You know, like it's not kind of a minor thing to do. And they just went ahead with it. You know, and 7 years later, not only is environmental protection in a hole in this country, we're also in a situation where the department isn't working for industry and developers and farmers either. We've just had a really important Auditor General's report come out that looked at the environmental assessment and approvals decisions. These are the decisions that allow projects to go ahead, and said, oh, actually, there's been a 510% increase in delays in approval decisions. Oh, and we had a look at the decisions, and 79% of the key decisions were being affected by error or were non-compliant. Oh. And in 2018-19 financial year, 95% of all key decisions were made outside the statutory timeframes. So they've actually managed, it's really remarkable. You know, we've got an environmental crisis, we've got a jobs crisis, they've managed to stuff up on both counts. And I think that comes back to this question of the ideology, not just of not caring about environmental protection, but this kind of neoliberal approach of saying we need smaller government and not thinking about the consequences of that. It's amazing. Fascinating to me, because the politics, this is so ridiculous. You know, the government can barely bring itself to utter the words climate change. You've got Craig Kelly, amateur sleuth Craig Kelly, going to the archives for the Bureau of Meteorology to try to catch out those bureaucrats.
With all of his expertise as a furniture salesman turned politician, he's the guy who I want making those decisions.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and then George Christensen piling on with, oh, you know, Craig Kelly's on the case, watch out, bureaucrats. Like, these guys are nuts, right? And at the same time, everyone who is serious, conservative, progressive, whatever, is saying, hey, climate change is a big problem. We've got to face up to climate change. You know, the government commissioned a drought coordinator's report, and that was produced last year. And it's just front and center. He's just like, look, guys, climate change is a real issue. He didn't say it in those words, of course, but because that's just me paraphrasing. He said it in much more serious language, but he talked front and centre about climate change in that report. So the people who are advising the government are clear with them about climate change, but we've got a government that's so beholden to these climate change deniers that they wrap themselves up in knots trying to avoid facing up to it. And I think that's a real shame, because we need a government that will take serious action on climate change. We're not going to have that while the coalition is in power.
I just find it so ridiculous that you have an opportunity for them to step away from their neoliberal rhetoric about, you know, small government, and to actually use the pandemic as a reason why we've got to get people back to work and we've got to spend money creating jobs. And clearly climate action is where the jobs are at. Like, there's an opportunity to renew and restructure the entire economy after coronavirus by actually investing in things like battery production and renewable energy and forest management and, you know, sustainable material production and restart Australian manufacturing, and yet we're talking about gas pipelines.
Well, I think most Australians want to see manufacturing on Australian soil, and one of the really interesting things about Ross Garnaut's book, which I bet you guys have read, which I thought was a really useful book, which is about renewables and the future, is that he's saying that effectively it's going to become more cost effective to manufacture onshore than it is to manufacture offshore in respect of new technologies, use of, you know, minerals that Australia has, because of two things. One, capital costs are low because of low interest rates, and two, the costs of actually transporting to have value added offshore will outweigh the costs of manufacturing onshore. So this sort of perfect storm is going to be a situation where we can look at manufacturing on Australian soil. Now, the government's talking about gas because they're using it as a proxy for energy prices, but you know, for neoliberals who are always banging on about how people shouldn't be picking winners, how governments shouldn't be in the business of trying to pick winners, they're pretty interested in finding ways to pick winners in relation to energy. I mean, they can't manage to land anything. They've had, I think at last count, something like 16 energy policies, this government. Wow. And that has caused a vast amount of uncertainty, lack of investment. That has itself put upward pressure on power prices. But, you know, for, as I said, for neoliberals, they're really quite interested in picking winners at the moment, aren't they? What they should be doing, and, you know, I'm no Malcolm Turnbull fan, but at least he professed to be agnostic about how best to lower power prices. What they should be doing is actually thinking about the economic sense of this. And you know, if they really believe in the market, then they shouldn't be trying to distort it. So I hope that this government is actually going to do the right thing. Land and energy policy, find something that there can be some bipartisanship around, because actually Australian manufacturing businesses and potential businesses of the future need certainty in relation to what's going to happen with energy. Well, I mean, the other great thing about protecting the environment, of course, is that if you have a better disposition towards environmental protection internationally, then that might assist with preventing animal-based viruses from crossing over into humanity, which might be a good thing.
Terry, that's just crazy talk.
Beautiful way to bring it all together, though, at the end, I think.
It's lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Terry.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so nice.
All right, Terry, we love you to bits.
Love you too. See you.
Bye.
And now for the good news this week. Van, tell us the good news.
Well, it looks like we're opening up a bit in Victoria, and it couldn't come at a better time. Spring has sprung, the blossoms are on the trees, and I think Victorians are literally gagging to spend more time out and about in the community. So it's been an incredible experience these months of lockdown since the second outbreak in Victoria, where we had that horrible period of more than 700 infections a day. We are now down to, Ben, how many are we down to in 5 weeks? What did Victoria get it down to? Do you know?
I think we're down below 40.
We are less than 40 a day now, which is amazing. Yesterday, there were no recorded deaths either, which is incredible. And the fact that, unlike countries like France, who are back in the grip of infections everywhere at the moment, what we've been through in Victoria of this hard lockdown for the past, I don't even know how long we've been doing this anymore, has really made the difference. To get down from more than 700 a day to less than 40 a day in 5 weeks is just phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a really good outcome. And obviously we live in regional Victoria, and we now get to jump two steps ahead, which is fantastic. We can now go to cafes and sit down.
Luxury.
As of midnight tonight. So there'll be...
That's the first thing I'm doing at midnight. I'm going to our local cafe, open or not, and I'm going to sit down.
I think there'll be a lot of regional people going to visit other regional towns, which we're now allowed to do.
Bossberg and Ballarat. Yeah, sorry, what?
They've been very, very keen on opening up. So, no, it is great news, and it's a real testament to the hard work of all Victorians who have sacrificed so much, really. And when you look at, as you say, those international numbers, Israel now, I think, has gone into a hard lockdown.
You're not allowed to go more than 500 metres from your house in Israel.
You know, France has 5,000 cases a day. England's now talking about another lockdown. It's really, really grim out there. And Victoria has managed to turn that corner. So keep up the good work, Victorians, and stay safe, everybody. And that is the week on Wednesday.
It is the week on Wednesday, Benjamin. As usual, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, on iTunes, on Google, on Podbean. We have a Twitter account, which is @WeekOnWednesday. We also have a Facebook page. We love the attention. And please, if there's anything you'd like us to talk about, just send us a message.
You can email us as well at theweekonwednesday@gmail.com. And we've had a few emails this week, so thank you very much to everyone. Our listener numbers continue to grow, so keep spreading the word around. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your co-workers. If you're getting out of lockdown, listen to us while you walk. We're getting lots of people telling us that they love listening to us while they go for their daily walk. So please.
Look, we know you're all in it for the dog. He is very cute.
So once again, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you next week for episode 6 of The Week on Wednesday. Love you, Vanny.
I love you too, baby.
Bye.